a very exciting period of Old Testament history. The period of the restoration of Israel to the land that God had promised unto Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We've noted that there is a general rule that was given from the time of Moses when he brought them up out of the land of Egypt, that if you do what I tell you to do, then I'll bless you. But if you do not, then I will most certainly curse you. And Moses told them that a number of times. Joshua, when he brought them into the promised land, assured them of that, that indeed not one thing had failed of all the good things that God had promised. And he assured them that just as surely as God had blessed them with these good things, he would also curse them and bring upon them evil things if indeed they worshipped and served other gods. Now, we've tracked through a whole bunch of years, and we noted that Joshua brought them in. During a period of time, they asked for a king to rule over them, and the first of the kings was King Saul, and King Saul started out to be a good king, but he didn't remain a good king. David then became king, and during the reign of David, things prospered. Solomon, David's son, became king. And during the days of Solomon, things continued to prosper with one exception. We know that Solomon had many, many wives. And I always get this turned around. 300 wives and 700 concubines, 700 wives and 300 concubines. Thanks for keeping me in line on that. 700 wives and 300 concubines. Well, we know that God had forbidden from Deuteronomy chapter 17 the kings to multiply wives. We also know from Deuteronomy chapter 7, he had forbidden the Israelites as a whole to intermarry among the heathen nations, the idolatrous worshipers round about them. But that's what Solomon did. And God told them way before that if you do that, then these wives will turn you away from God and will cause you to worship idols. And during the days of Solomon, that's just exactly what happened. And Solomon began to worship idols and build places of worship unto these idols. Well, we know that after Solomon, his son Rehoboam became king. Rehoboam, very foolish, had the opportunity to listen to the wisdom of the great men that had counseled with his father. But he also chose to listen to the so-called wisdom of the young men. And instead of following the wisdom of the counselors of his father to lighten the burdens of the people, he increased the burdens of the people. Well, the people rebelled, and they sought another king. And the man they brought was King Jeroboam, who came up out of Egypt and began to introduce calf worship. Set one up in Baal, one down in Bethel, and one up in Dan, and said to the people, it's too much for you to travel to Jerusalem. Worship here. And the people began then to worship the calf, the golden calves that King Jeroboam had set up. Now, from that point forward, there were many kings in the northern 10 tribes. Note, not one, not a single one served the Lord. Not one. Now, God sent prophet after prophet after prophet to them, calling upon them to repent. He sent pestilences of various types and kinds, and famines, and wars, and all of these things to cause them to realize their dependence upon Him, and they would not turn unto Him. And so Amos writes in chapter 4, in verse 12, prepare to meet thy God, O Israel. God's had enough. Now, after their coming into the land, and God being patient with them, and their continued rebellion against God, the city of Samaria was conquered or overthrown by the Assyrians, depending on what source you read, about 721, 722 B.C., and they were carried away captive. Now, that was the end of the northern kingdom. But the king of Assyria, and I want to continue to impress you with this, The king of Assyria sent message down to Hezekiah. Now, Hezekiah needs to stand as a benchmark for us because it's during his reign in Judah he is continuing to be faithful to God when the northern kingdom is taken captive. So now you have the southern kingdom standing alone. Israel to the north is taken captive. And this is during the reign of King Hezekiah. And the king of Assyria says to Hezekiah, you need to surrender. The gods of all these other nations haven't been able to save them. What makes you think your God can save you? And then he turned to the people on the wall and spoke to them in the Hebrew language and instructed them the same thing. Don't listen to Hezekiah. He's going to get you all killed. Surrender, and you can stay in the land. Things will be wonderful. You can have fruits and vineyards and so forth and so on, and I'll give you horses and all these kind of things. In other words, trying to bribe them into surrendering, and they would not surrender. And Richard, I really like the way that you put it. When the king of Assyria woke up in the morning to charge the city of Jerusalem, what did he find? So that's right. 185,000 woke up dead. And so Randy, he wound up his ball of yarn, and he went back to Nineveh, where it had been prophesied that he would be slain. And he was by his two sons, strangely enough, in the idol temple where he was worshiping. Now, that pretty well ended things with Assyria. But now we've got Judah down here, who has good kings from this point on and some bad kings. And we're winding up, or have wound up, really, our study of the southern kingdom with Judah being taken captive by the Babylonians. We know that Jeremiah prophesied extensively about this. We read in the Chronicles and the Kings about some of these events. And we know that during this time, Jeremiah came to Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and he presented him with a scroll, rebuking him for the things that he was doing. And what did Jehoiakim do with it, John? He burnt it. Can you imagine taking the scroll of God and cutting it up with a knife and throwing it in the fire? But that's what he did. That's exactly what he did. And we know that during then, the days of Zedekiah, who was kind of a puppet king in the southern kingdom, he was taken captive away by the Babylonians, and things were not so good. And so the southern kingdom eventually came to a halt. Now, when we look at these books on the board, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, these books are written during this time of restoration. Now, the word remnant keeps cropping up every once in a while. What does that suggest to us? This rule, you do what I say and I'll bless you. You don't, and I'll curse you. Always a few that's going to be faithful. That's right. And even in Babylonian captivity, there were a few that were among the faithful. Now, long before the Babylonian captivity, during the time preceding the Assyrian captivity, a prophet by the name of Isaiah had prophesied that a man by the name of Cyrus would one day write a decree and let anyone who wanted to go home. Now, the interesting thing about that is that the Babylonian kingdom that conquered the Assyrian kingdom had not become a world empire yet, and the Medo-Persian empire was not even a gleam in its mother's eye, not been thought about yet, much less Cyrus even being born. Now, when you look at that, 200 years or so before, Isaiah named the name of the man and told precisely what he would do, how that he would dry up the rivers and march into the city and take it without a fight. And secular history tells us that's just exactly what Cyrus, the king of the Persian Empire, did. He diverted the river Euphrates, which flowed through the city of Babylon. And when he diverted the river Euphrates, he and his soldiers just marched right up the dry riverbed and took the city of Babylon without even a fight. So Cyrus became the king then of what was known as the Medo-Persian Empire. And you begin reading in the book of Ezra in chapter 1 where Ezra writes the record of Cyrus writing this decree, telling them that they can go home. Now, this is a fascinating part, I believe, of Old Testament history because we see the providence of God involved in fulfilling just exactly what He had said by Isaiah 200 years before. Now, if you want to look at that text, it's the last couple of verses of Isaiah chapter 44, reading on into the first two or three verses of Isaiah chapter 45. And you'll see the man's name given and what he would do, how the waters would be dried up and so forth. But to catch on to our period of time, we look in chapter 3 of the book of Ezra, and it's a great day. They have made plans to come into the city of Jerusalem and to rebuild. And they come under the direction of Ezra to rebuild with the king's commission, with the king's money, and with the king's instruction to governors that lived in that land to provide them whatever they needed. Now that would sound like a grand occasion, wouldn't it? Wonderful day. But when they came into the land, what did they find? There are people there. And that seems to be a problem, don't it? It seems that every time God promises a certain land to a certain people and then they get there, lo and behold, there's people that are there and they think it's a mighty fine land. And so when they came into the land, we find that there were people there. Now, these people presented some problems to the Israelites. This brings us over to the book of, as we're in Ezra, also the book of Haggai, where they meet with opposition from those who live there. We've talked about the Samaritans and the Ammonites and the Edomites and the Arabs who began to expand their dominion because the Israelites had been taken into Babylonian captivity. And, of course, we've talked about the Ammonites, how that for a long time they had their target set on the land of Gilead because it was such a fertile place to raise livestock and so forth. And when you look down here, you see barren wilderness in the desert Negev, thank you. And then the Arabs over here in the Arabian desert. So all of this looks very attractive to them, and they're just moving in. And so when the Israelites come with the desire to rebuild Jerusalem, and in particular the temple and the walls around the city, there are people there that don't want them to do that. So what then do the inhabitants of the land do in Ezra chapter 4? Yes. Yeah, the drama of this is better than a soap opera, isn't it? So they write to the king, they say, well, you need to do the research. These are bad people. This is a bad city and rebellious people, and you don't want them to come back into the land and find a foothold in this land again. Now, the king, yes. Yes, oh, that's a biggie. You won't get taxes from them. If they get a foothold in this land again. That's right. So he did the investigation, the king did, and looked back into the history, keeping in mind that he had the history at hand of the Assyrian kings, the Babylonian kings, because now he's conquered all of that. And when he looks back into their history, what does he find? Oh, that's the truth. Yeah. You go back and look, that's what they were. They were a troublesome people, a rebellious people. And so consequently, he ordered that even by force, that the building of the temple cease. Now they've laid a foundation, and then this order came. The temple has ceased to be rebuilt. Now, what did the people do during this time of the sanction, I guess you might call it, against building the temple. They built their own houses. That's right. If we can't build the temple of God, we'll build our own houses. Well, did they spare any finances on building their own? Oh, no, they had fine houses, while the temple of God lay essentially in ruins. Don't know that. I don't know if they stockpiled them or if they used them to build their own houses. Don't know that. Simply not told. Except in the book of Haggai, the first chapter, their argument was the time to build is not yet. Well, why? Because of opposition. People don't want us to. We've got the decree of the king not to build. And we've got enemies here that won't let us build. And so even by force, we're prevented from building. So what they did with those particular materials, don't know. Now, one of the things we do need to be reminded of is that regarding those things that Cyrus had provided for the rebuilding of the temple included the gold and the silver and many of the things that had been taken from the temple by the Babylonians. He's returning those things to them. And so supplies are, some of these type supplies are very special. They're not things that you can just go to Walmart and buy. So these were things that were returned by the king. But they continue under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah, Zerubbabel, and Haggai to accomplish the building. Now, interestingly enough, three things I want us to remember. I put a star by some of these charts so that I'd really spend a little time on them and not just zoom past them. Others we're going to zoom past. But the three returns in Ezra, or during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. Number one, the Jews return home under the leadership of Zerubbabel to build the temple. The book of Haggai and Ezra, chapters 3 through chapter 6, becomes the outline for that portion of our study. And then number two, Ezra returns with the priest to start the spiritual reform. And we read about that in Ezra chapter 3. And then Nehemiah returns to build the walls. And we read about that in the book of Nehemiah. The time frame is about 444 B.C. Keep in mind that the temple was built first under the leadership of Haggai about 520 to 516 or so B.C. And then the walls built by Nehemiah about 444 B.C. But as we talk about the Jews returning under the leadership of Zerubbabel, they began to work, but they began to run into problems with that through the opposition. And the temple then, after they had laid the foundation, it just stopped. It just stopped. Now, when the foundation was laid, we've got two reactions. One from the old men and one from the younger folks. What was the reaction of the old men when they saw the laying of the foundation? They cried. Now, we see evidence of that not only in Ezra, but also in Nehemiah. They cried. Why? Okay. All right. When we look at the things that are beginning to develop, the old men remember the way it was. With all its glory and all its splendor, the temple built by Solomon has now been destroyed by the Babylonians. How long has it been since the temple was destroyed? 70 years. Yes, 70 years. Prophesied by Jeremiah would be 70 years. And 70 years to the date, we know that they were released to come forth. Now, when we talk about old men, we're talking about those who saw the temple and its glory in their younger years. And now here they're old and they're returned to the land and they see the laying of the foundation. It'd be difficult to imagine it ever being like it was. Jenny?
I think that might also be compounded by them being so young when they saw it initially. So what Solomon was saying, they were if you go back to the house you grew up in, it looks a lot smaller.
Yeah.
Than
that's true.
So they have for 70 years, and so they have built it up even more in their heads, and now this is just paltry.
Yeah. Yeah, as we would say in Kentucky, this is chicken liver. It's just nothing. And so, that's right. But the younger men, they think they're accomplishing a great thing. They're laying the foundation, and they're doing what God wants them to do until this opposition started. Now, we'll not spend time again on where the Samaritans came from and so forth. But because of the work of these adversaries, the building of the temple ceased. How long? 16 years. During this time, they're doing their thing, building their houses, but the temple lies in ruins. And this brings us to the book of Nehemiah. One of these days, very soon, we're going to do somewhat of an overview of the book of Nehemiah itself. Just go right through the book. I prefer to do that than to hit and miss points along the way, as we're going to do. In this, but what I want you to see is in Nehemiah chapter 2, we read about Sanballat the Horonite. Now, we want to identify him as a Samaritan. He was a Samaritan, the Horonite. And because, let me get past some of these. Hard for me to talk and push that button. Okay, that'd probably get us about far enough. Okay. Sir? Jenny, you got your... And look up the Horonites. And that'll answer your question. It's from the area of Samaria. He was a Samaritan. And what we want to note is in chapter 2 of the book of Nehemiah, reading beginning in verse 17, it says, "Then said I unto them, ye see how, or see the evil case that we are in, how Jerusalem lieth waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come, let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that we be no more a reproach. And I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me." We'll have to talk more about that later. It said, "And also of the king's words that he had spoken unto me." More about that later. "And they said, let us rise up and build." There's your sermon, Randy. "So they strengthened their hands for the good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite, and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arabian heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, what is this thing that ye do? Will ye rebel against the king? Then answered I them and said unto them, the God of heaven, he will prosper us. Therefore we, his servants, will arise and build. But ye have no portion, nor right, nor memorial in Jerusalem." Now you remember our map a few moments ago that identified the Arabians over here and the region of the Samaritans up in the middle? Yes. Okay. Okay, well, that brings us over on the Transjordan side then. Well, now, wait a minute. Ephraim had a divided portion. Ephraim had some on the west side of the Jordan, had some on the east side of the Jordan. If I'm not mistaken in my understanding, that which was on the west side of the Jordan would be the region of Samaria. Is that about right? Okay, I thought that was right. Manasseh also got a divided portion, and Ephraim got a divided portion. So, yeah, we're still talking about the Samaritans. Well, let me get my map. Well, there it is, on the west side. It's right across from the northern part of the Dead Sea, just under Manasseh. Look at the maps of the settlement in Canaan. Look at the maps of the settlement in Canaan when they came in and took the land, when it's divided. You've got Manasseh up in the land of Gilead, and you've got Manasseh about the middle of the Jordan, West Jordan Valley. And then south of that, between Manasseh and Judah, you have Ephraim. See it there? Pardon me? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this tells us kind of where he is. So you've got the opposition from several different directions telling the children of Israel, stop building. Now, the point I want you to see is that Nehemiah said, that's not any of your business. You just go away and leave us alone. That's none of your business. You have no part nor lot in this matter. This is our business. Now, we've studied earlier where that when they began to build back in Ezra, was it chapter 2, I believe, where the Samaritans said, let us help you build the temple. And the Samaritans, their history, as we said, we weren't going to talk about that today, but their history was in the practice of idolatry. They believed that they could worship the Lord just like all other idols, they thought. And so as far as they're having a share in the rebuilding of the temple of God, the Israelites said, nuh-uh, we're not going to do that. We're just not going to do that. You go away. That's not your business. And so we will rebuild. Now, I'm going to blink that off for just a moment. And let's look, if you would please, at the book of Nehemiah. The book of Nehemiah. You know, when you begin to do any kind of work, and those of you who are involved in the aerospace industry, if, John, you want to start a project, I'm going to just jump out here on a limb because I know nothing about that, but I'm going to jump out on a limb and say that there is some prerequisite work that you have to do to find out what needs to be accomplished to build this airplane. That'd be about right? That's generally true in almost anything that you do. You plan it out. You look and see what has to be done. In chapter 3, we see that that's essentially what Nehemiah is doing. He's looking about to see what needs to be done. And then he begins to divide up the work among the various families of the Israelites. Now, that would seem to be necessary. You've got to organize the people. You work on this part. You work on this part. Even as simple as an illustration as it is, when we plan a work day around the building, we don't give everybody a rake and say, go out and rake. Because we know there are other jobs that need to be done if we're to accomplish the things that we want to do in a reasonable amount of time. And so we've got some to go out and rake. We've got some to work on sprinkler heads. We've got some to mow and some to do some trimming and some to do things on the inside. You organize the work, isn't that right? That's what Nehemiah does. He organizes the work. Now, in organizing the work, and the work begins to progress, Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem, they're over here on the sidelines watching what they do not want to watch. The work of rebuilding the walls is being accomplished. And in chapter 4, in verse 3, we note that Tobiah the Ammonite said, even if a fox go up, he shall break down their stone wall. What's he saying to them? He don't know what you're doing. It's not going to stay. You can build that, but if an animal crosses it, it'll all fall down. And you'll note in verse 6, Nehemiah, the text tells us, so we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together unto half the height thereof, for the people had a mind to work. Now, you can take people that have a mind to work, and you can do a whole lot in a short amount of time. Now, again, back to my oversimplified illustration, when we come down to the building for a work day. If everybody shows up, and we've got some out here with rakes and hoes, and some with lawnmowers, and some with edgers, and some working inside, some washing windows, some doing bathrooms, etc., etc., how long does it take to knock it out, and we're done? 27 minutes. You forgot about the seconds. Okay? I didn't realize it was that precise. Okay? But you see the point. When you've got the work organized and people are willing to work, you can knock it out in a hurry. And we see that the people here had a mind to work. Now, there are all kinds of efforts to stop it by these enemies of God's people. And again, we'll talk about that. I'm so tempted to just go through the book of Nehemiah, but I want to do that more thoroughly at another time. But what we need to see is that the walls went up. And during the time of Haggai, the temple is going up. They're building it because they have leadership, because they have a willingness and a determination to do what Cyrus has instructed them to do. Now, let's backtrack just a little bit. Go in reverse. We said that this decree had been written by the king to stop the work, and it was stopped for 16 years. The people then, under the leadership of these men, began to build. And the opposition said, wait just a minute. We have this decree signed by the king saying you can't do that. By whose authority do you build? Now let's turn back to the book of Ezra. The book of Ezra, and look if you would please in verse 5, or chapter 5, verse 3. Chapter 5, verse 3. Latter part of that verse, you'll notice the question. Who gave you a decree to build this house and to finish this wall? Do you see that? Now, I want you to see what they're asking. It's a legitimate question. By what authority are you doing this? Now, those of you who have studied with us in our authority study know the relevance, the importance of that question. By whose authority do you do this? It's a good question. We need to ask that question more frequently. Though these were enemies asking that question, doesn't mean it's an irrelevant question. When the question is asked in the New Testament, in what passage? This is a test. Matthew 21, verses 23 through 27, yes. The leaders of the Jews came to Jesus with the question, by what authority doest thou these things? And Jesus asked them, the baptism of John, whence was it? From heaven or from men? And they reasoned among themselves, and they said, if John baptized by the authority of heaven, then he'll say, why didn't you believe him? Well, that's right, because John's baptism was preparatory for the coming of Jesus. Or if we say that John baptized by the authority of men, we fear the multitudes, for all hold John as a prophet. So what'd they say? We don't know. I believe they were lying. I think they did know. They just didn't want to tell. Now, when we look at that text, the question, though these were enemies of Jesus, the question was legit. By what authority do you do these things? We need to ask that question. Notice, if you will, that Jesus gave two possibilities, heaven or men. Now, when we look at the text of Ezra, and the enemies of God's people are asking the question, who gave you the decree to build this house and to finish this wall? Verse 3, same chapter, chapter 5, verse 9. You see it stated again. Who gave you a decree to build this house and to finish this wall? Now let's answer that question. Were they building the wall and the house of God by the authority of heaven or of men? They were building it by the authority of heaven. For we know that it was God who had moved Cyrus to write that decree. It was God who had prophesied through Isaiah long before Cyrus was ever born, long before the Medo-Persian Empire over which he ruled had ever been established. So this was by the decree of God that the house of God be built. Now, their reference is the king named Cyrus wrote a decree. Now, you folks who are enemies who went before the king and you said to the king, research these people. Find out what kind of people they are. They're rebellious people. You let them have a foothold and things won't go well for you. And so he did the research and he found that that was true. And so he wrote an order to stop the rebuilding of the wall. But now when they start up rebuilding under the leadership of these men, and the question is asked, by whose authority do you do this? They say, long time ago, Cyrus wrote a decree. Now, go back and do your homework. And so what does this king have to do? Go back and look at the records. And he looks a little farther back to find that they're not just a troublesome people, but these people, while in captivity by Cyrus, received a decree from Cyrus. You remember chapter 1 of Ezra? And it was this king, Cyrus, who provided for them provisions from their people who did not want to go back and from the king's treasury with letters to the governors who lived in the land to give them whatever they need. Now, what do you do about that, Mr. King? What do you do with that? That's right. And so he wrote another decree. And he said, what Cyrus said, that's what we're going to do. And if you're not willing to do that, then you'll be hanged. And your house will be turned into a dunghill. Now, I want to know just how far you'd want to pursue your opposition to the king and the rebuilding of the temple and the rebuilding of the walls. How far you want to go with that? That stopped it, didn't it? And the people began to build because that's what God told them to do. Now, the map that we have on the board just simply shows us the dominion of this man. I still need to shorten that arrow. Not the Adriatic Sea, but the Aegean Sea. Macedonia and Thrace were areas that Cyrus had and Darius had expanded the kingdom to these outermost borders. And we talked about the Suez Canal, that we think we dreamed that up, and we note that we didn't dream that up. This Persian king dreamed that up for the same reason, so that passage from the Red Sea into the Mediterranean Sea by commercial ships could be accomplished. Now, Darius conquered new territories. We've talked about that in our study on Wednesday night, the great things that he did in building the Suez Canal initially. And we talked about the comparison of the land of Judah, as you'll see it developing over here, to the square mileage of the United States when we think of this little area here where the Jews lived, about 2 million square miles. And then when you consider the United States, I understand that the continental United States is about 3 million square miles. So we're not talking about something all that big in comparison to what Darius had, you see. Just a little bitty spot over here, a little bitty place. I think sometimes when we think of the United States and we think of 300,000 or 3 million square miles, we think of something huge. Well, now, granted, I wouldn't want to have to walk across it. But I need to make a backdrop and lay the United States across this. Which one do you think is bigger? Pardon me? The Medo-Persian. Oh, yes. Yes, by far. And so that's just kind of an interesting thing. We'll throw that. Pardon me? Yeah, here.
Right. Yeah.
That is right. Yeah, that is right. Yes, you're right. I apologize. That is right. Yeah, the whole empire, 2 million square miles. So it would be smaller than the United States. But that's still pretty good size. When you think about the role of Judah in that. Well, let's look at some other things. When King Darius came to power, Haggai and Zechariah urged the people to resume the work. Open your Bible, if you will, please, to the Old Testament text of Haggai. Haggai. And we're going to have a lesson on this, too, just a kind of a verse-by-verse study of the book of Haggai. Lost my clicker. The book of Haggai. In Haggai chapter 1, look at verse 2. Haggai chapter 1, verse 2. Thus speaketh Jehovah of hosts, saying, this people say, it is not time for us to come, the time for Jehovah's house to be built. Then came the word of Jehovah by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it a time for you yourselves to dwell in your sealed houses, while this house lieth waste? Now therefore, thus saith Jehovah of hosts, consider your ways. You've sown much, and bring in little. Ye eat, but ye have not enough. Ye drink, but you're not filled with drink. Ye clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages to put it into a bag with holes. That sound familiar? Sometimes we look at the text here and we say, well, I can relate to that. Yeah. Well, the problem here was God was not blessing them because they were not doing what He had told them to do. They were not rebuilding the temple. But they were taking the time to build their own houses. And what they needed was somebody to light a fire under them. And sometimes we can just rock along and be so complacent from day to day, month to month, year to year, and we don't do anything. And we need somebody to build a fire under us. And that's what Ezra and Haggai and Nehemiah did. They built a fire under the people. Because indeed the decree had been written. It was found. The new king has given orders that anybody who opposes the work is to be hanged. His house will be destroyed. So what's your problem? Get busy. Go to work and rebuild. Now you'll note that they rebuilt the temple in about 4 years after this. Well, they've been in there for about 16 years. What's up with that? And they could have built it in four. And you see what people can do when somebody lights a fire under them? You see what people can do when they're determined with conviction to serve the Lord? You see, it don't take 200 people to turn something into something big. As I was studying with someone just Friday, I believe, wasn't it, Randy? That one person and God, that makes a majority. And that's right. One person and God, that makes a majority. Old Testament history, for example, when you look back and read about Jonathan, who was the son of King Saul, and his servant. When the Philistines had the army of Israel at a standstill, Jonathan and his servant charged an encampment of the Philistines, and what did they do on their first charge? They killed 20 people. Then they charged again. And when they began to see, the people began to see the success that Jonathan and his servant was having, they joined in and conquered the Philistines. You see, sometimes we just need to see what's possible, what can be done. Now, the book of Esther. Such a fascinating study. During this time period is when we read of the events of Esther. Now, Esther is a book sometimes that hides, like some do of these little short books. But if you'll turn over to Ezra and Nehemiah, you'll note that the next book is the book of Esther. The book of Esther. And you'll note that it takes place approximately between chapter 6 and 7 of the book of Ezra. If you want to kind of place that in chronological order. The book of Esther is a fascinating book discussing the providence of God. And how that the Jews were to be spared. Now, I'm probably going to have a whole lesson on Esther someday, real soon. So you expect that, don't you? Because I want us to have these thoughts in mind as we're studying these things. We've talked about Esther before, but I want it to be fresh in our thinking as we're studying this portion of history. Now, we know that there was a queen, her name was Vashti, and she was married to King, was it Xerxes or Artaxerxes? Xerxes, thank you. Under the title of Ahasuerus. Yes, thank you. And so what we learn is that Vashti had done one of two things. She had maintained her honor or she had dishonored the king. It's my judgment that she had maintained her honor. But be that as it may, the king was entertaining a bunch of other kings and princes and high-ranking people, and he got them all drunk. And he invited Vashti, his wife, to come in and show them her beauty. And she wouldn't do it. Now, if you want to picture something immoral into that, that's my take on it. But others don't agree with that. But be that as it may, the point being is she was going to be booted out as queen. And someone else was to become the queen of the ruler of the Medo-Persian Empire. Now, through a process of events, Esther became queen. Now, meanwhile, back at the ranch, we've got her uncle, some think cousin, who was named Mordecai. And Mordecai did not bow down and pay homage to a man named Haman, who was the king's right-hand man. And Haman hated him for it. And he devised a plot whereby he might kill Mordecai, you remember the story? And as he devised that plot whereby he might kill Mordecai, it involved the king writing a decree to kill all the Jews, because you see, Mordecai was a Jew. Now, that sounds good, don't it, if you're Haman? Well, the problem was, the king, he didn't realize that he was married to a Jew. And her name was Esther. Now we've got a problem, you see. Mordecai came to Esther and said to Esther, you need to approach the king on behalf of the Jews. Now this is a real important story as far as the development of the scheme of redemption is concerned. What if all the Jews were killed? What happened to the promise of God to bring through the lineage of Judah a Savior? That wouldn't be. Yeah, it wouldn't be. So what we want to note in that is there had to be some way to upset the plan of Haman. And it looks like we'll have to talk about that next time because we're out of time. But I would encourage you to continue reading the book of Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, and the book of Esther. And I would suggest to you that when you begin to read the book of Esther, you'll find it difficult to stop until you finished it. Fascinating study. All right, we'll stop with that. Again there next time. Esther.